You're sitting in a bar. I say you're sitting because I don't go to bars, and I know that some of you do. Just kidding. But you're sitting in a bar. You're listening to your friend recount for the 50th time the clutch pass in the last seconds of the state championship that he made 50 years ago. Right? You've heard this story many times, but he keeps telling it. And it was something that you remember sharing with him in high school. What's your friend doing? What is he reliving? What do we call that? He's reliving his what?
Glory days.
Glory days. Glory is a very Christian word. We use the word glory all the time in church. But I imagine if I were to ask you to write down a definition of the word glory, we would all have a difficult time doing that. It is a difficult word to define, although I think it's a very common concept. Glory, as I'm going to define it, and you can disagree with me or not, but not right now, disagree with me later. Glory is the outward manifestation of a person's or a thing's essence or character. Glory is the outward manifestation of a person or a thing's inner essence or character. Now, we tend to boast or brag about those things that we believe reveal our true essence and character, whether they do or not. When we say that someone glories in something, what he's doing or she's doing or what this guy was doing when he's telling you about his football past is he is telling you a story or giving you an account of something that manifests some quality or character about himself that he thinks he has or that he values. If you brag about, for example, your GPA, you tell everybody about their place that you hold in your class. Well, the reason you probably do that is because you're trying to say to those people who will listen to you that you're an intelligent person. That's an essence or an aspect of your character that you want them to know. If you drive a Ferrari around town and flash wads of cash, you're glorying in something, and you're glorying in this outward display of wealth that you may believe testifies to some inner quality, hard work, achievement, you're just a successful person. These are outward glorifying displays that point towards something inside. Now, Aiden's about to start baseball this year, and I didn't think I'd be one of those fathers. But last year, he just started, and he as he got better over the year, I started, that's my son. Did you see a hit? He just made a hit. That was my son. And because for some reason, I felt like, and I don't know where it comes from, but men tend to do this, but I felt like his actions said something about the superiority of my masculine genes or something. I don't know what it was. Well, that's my son, right. So we glory in various things, and what you glory in will tell you a little bit about who you think you are and who someone else thinks he is or she is. What people glory in tells you a lot. Now, the Gospel of Mark was written in the city, most likely, of Rome and two Christians who lived in Rome. Romans gloried in a number of things. They boasted about a number of things that tells us what they valued. They boasted of military conquest, their superiority over other nations. They boasted of their bringing law and order to the world. They boasted about their economic prosperity. And the things they boasted about tell us that Romans understood their essence and quality as being a dignified people, a disciplined people, a tenacious people, stern in their justice during the political season. You'll hear the word gravitas thrown around. That person has gravitas, that person doesn't have gravitas. That's a Roman quality of dignity and honor and weightiness. They consider themselves unflinching in courage and unequaled in strength. The opposite, the things that a Roman would not glory in or boast about, are things that pertain to weakness. Any kind of weakness for Romans was a source of humiliation and shame. So when a Roman commander would lose a great battle, it was expected sometimes for him to take his own life. That was really the only way out of a loss like that to preserve face, if you didn't die in the battle. If you lose your fortune, if you lose your political standing, suicide is often seen as the best course. Why would you go on living as someone who's been shown to be weak and not embodying Roman virtues? Now, all of this, I think, explains why the Romans used crucifixion. Dying naked, slowly, in excruciating pain, your weakness visible to the world, utterly helpless, would be the most shameful way for a Roman to die. And so they didn't put Romans to death that way. They would put people who were not Romans to death that way. The utter humiliation. Cicero, writing about 100 years before Jesus' crucifixion, said this: it's a crime to put a Roman citizen in chains. What then of crucifixion? It's impossible to find the word for such an abomination. The very word, cross, let it be far removed not only from the bodies of Roman citizens, but even from their thoughts and their eyes and their ears. It's such a humiliating shame to die in such a way. Romans are strong, victorious, powerful, dignified. So let's just say you're a Roman. Let's say you're a rather wealthy Roman, and another rather wealthy Roman invites you to his house for a gathering in which you're going to hear about some new Eastern god. Eastern gods were, or the cults of Eastern gods were coming into Rome all the time, and this is just another one. So you go, and a scroll is opened, and the person who opens a scroll reads to you Mark chapter 15, let's just say beginning in verse 16, all the way to 32. What are you thinking? These people are here worshiping this man, celebrating this man, this crucified Jew. If you look at the cover of your bulletin, I hope you got a bulletin, but if you did, I want you to look at the cover of it. That is first century Roman graffiti found on Palatine Hill, inscribed in a wall. There's a man crucified. His head is the head of a donkey. You see that? And there's a man underneath the man who's crucified, and he's worshiping. And the inscription reads, Aximenos worships his God. Aximenos worships his God. This is first century Roman mocking of Jesus and his followers. This is what Romans would think of a man who dies on a cross. And this is what Romans would think of a man who worships a man who dies on a cross. You're a jackass, and you're worshiping a jackass. That's not bad language. It's a donkey, but that's what they're saying. That's what they'd be doing. If God wanted to find a culturally sensitive way to introduce himself to Romans, sending his son to the cross is the worst possible way to do it. It's kind of interesting if you think about our efforts at evangelism. Sometimes we often want to make Jesus look as cool as we possibly can. God didn't do that. He chose the most offensive sign and symbol in the first century Roman realm. And he came and he put himself on that, so that all those who were going to follow Jesus must also be willing to be thought of as fools. Ridiculous, absurd. Must be willing to be humiliated, embarrassed in front of their friends and family. Are you willing to do that? to be there for Jesus. Paul writes in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 18, "The word of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing." The word of the cross, the word of a man who is God dying on the cross, is utter foolishness to those who are perishing. But to those who are being saved, he says, it is the power of salvation. It is the means by which God saves us. In Galatians 6, he writes, "Far be it from me to boast," in other words, to glory in, "far be it from me to boast in anything except the cross of Jesus Christ our Lord." That would have hit first century culture like a brick wall. "What are you talking about? That's crazy. Far be it from me to boast in anything except the cross of our Lord Jesus Christ." For Paul, the cross is a sense, is the source of boasting. For Paul, the cross is the glory of God, the glory of Christ. It is something that manifests something about the essence of Jesus and the essence of God, the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. What is that thing? How does something so ugly and cruel serve to glorify God? Well, hopefully we'll find that out. Let's dive in. Chapter 15, beginning in verse 21. Jesus here has been scourged already. He's bleeding profusely. He's weak. He's now to be led from the praetorium where he has been scourged to his execution. The soldiers take a flat wooden board that would have been chalked white, and written on that board in red letters would be his crime, whatever it is, and they hang that board around his neck. Then they would lift a heavy cross beam onto his shoulders. You've probably seen pictures of Jesus carrying a big old cross behind him. He would have carried just the cross beam on his shoulders. The soldiers lift that onto him, and then they begin to drive him forward with whips, like an animal. Now, we know it's a short distance. He doesn't go very far, or he shouldn't have to go very far to get to the place where he's crucified. But it is a long walk, and the reason for that is that Romans paraded condemned criminals through the busiest streets of town on purpose to show the populace what happens to people who defy Rome. So it would have been a long and winding journey for Jesus from the praetorium to the place of execution. But Jesus himself isn't able to go far. He's been scourged. He's bleeding again profusely. He's exhausted. And so in verse 21, you see the Romans compel a passerby, Simon of Cyrene, who is coming in from the country, the father of Alexander and Rufus, to carry his cross. Cyrene is on the coast of modern-day Libya. There was a large Jewish community there. And we can assume that Simon was a Jew coming in from the country, that means arriving into Jerusalem, from his travels for the feast. He's probably coming for the Passover. What a great welcome he just received. Come into town, and here's this horrific scene unfolding before his eyes, and he's compelled by the Romans to take the cross off of Jesus' shoulders, or take the cross beam off Jesus' shoulders, and carry it for him. Now you wonder if their eyes met. You wonder if any words were spoken here. We don't know. We do know that Mark mentions his sons. Do you see that? Alexander and Rufus? There's only one reason for Mark to mention his sons, and that's that his readers know his sons. His readers in the Roman church know Alexander and Rufus. What does that tell us? Well, it tells us that most likely at some point Simon, perhaps even at this moment as he lifted the cross from Jesus, at some point God lifted Simon up and turned his heart to faith in Jesus Christ. Maybe it was here, I don't know. But at some point he believed and he passed on that faith to his children, Alexander and Rufus. Paul, in Romans chapter 16, verse 13, greets Rufus, who's in the Roman church, and his mother, and talks about his warm feelings for them. So this is not just a chance encounter. It must have seemed like that. Poor Simon, again, walking into town, greeted with this horrific scene, carries the cross of Jesus, but his whole life is changed. Don't always be upset with interruptions in your life, even if they seem to be horrible ones. Simon carries Jesus' cross, and it changes his life and that of his families. Look at verse 22. Simon has carried the cross through the streets. Jesus has most likely gone before him. And they come finally, in verse 22, to the place called Golgotha, which means place of the skull. Now, the hill may have been shaped like a skull, but it's also where Romans killed people. So the name makes sense either way, if it's both, right? The Church of the Holy Sepulchre, Ann and I went there when we were in Jerusalem. Has anyone ever been there, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem? It's built over the traditional site of Golgotha. There's another site, too, called Gordon's Calvary, right next to an Israeli bus station. The diesel fumes just billow up. Not sure where exactly this is. We don't know. Both sites now are inside the city of Jerusalem, but in Jesus' day, both sites would have been outside the walls. That's where the executions were done, outside the walls. Here I'd like you to go ahead and turn to Leviticus chapter 16, that marker that I gave you. In October, every year, on a certain day, the high priest of Israel would take a bull and two goats. He would slaughter the bull and one of the goats, and you can look there in verse 15 through 18. He would take the bull and one of the goats, and he would sprinkle the blood on the altar, and then he would go inside the Holy of Holies. This is the only time of the year he was allowed to go into the Holy of Holies. He would go inside the Holy of Holies, and he would sprinkle the Ark of the Covenant with the blood, and then he would come out, and imagine this in 21st century culture, where we're all really worried about unclean things, and he would just sprinkle the crowd with the blood of the bull and the goat. He would just take probably a hyssop leaf and sprinkle the people with blood. Then he would take the other goat, and he would put his hands over the head of that second goat, and he would confess Israel's sins. This was an act of transfer. The sins of Israel were given over to the head of the goat. And the goat would then be driven out of Jerusalem, out of the city, out of the camp, into the wilderness far away. Now, what's going on here? Well, one of the goats dies in Israel's place. Its blood, the cleansing agent, or represents anyway the cleansing of the people. The other goat takes the sin away. Both end up outside the city, the place of shame, the place where the unclean things go. You want to get the sin as far away from the community as you possibly can. So the goat that's driven out is driven out, and the goat that was killed is, you can see in verse 27, burned outside the city. Now turn, if you will, to Hebrews 13 and look at verses 11 and 12, and we'll see what the author of Hebrews does with this. The author of Hebrews sees the Day of Atonement, which is what we just learned about, what we just read about. The author of Hebrews sees the Day of Atonement as a marker, as a symbol, as a sign planted by God in the feasts and fasts of Israel, pointing forward to what we're reading right now in Mark chapter 15. And he says, so Jesus, this is verse 12, also suffered outside the gate, the place of shame. The place where the unclean things go. The place where you destroy and take those things that are impure so they do not contaminate the community. Jesus also suffered outside the gate in order to sanctify, that's cleanse, that's make holy the people through his own blood. Now just think about it, because in the the text we've been reading today and yesterday or last week, Jesus has sprinkled his blood everywhere. He was struck in the face before Annas. He was beaten by the Sanhedrin after his trial before them. He's been scourged, as David talked to us about last week, before the Romans. And now he's bled throughout the city. He sprinkled his blood everywhere throughout Jerusalem. And now he's being taken outside the camp where he'll be destroyed. Jesus fulfills the Day of Atonement here. He is the atoning sacrifice. He is the one who removes sin from the camp. Does anyone see it? Well, let's go on. The procession arrives at Golgotha. Let's go back to chapter 15, verse 23 of Mark. The procession arrives at Golgotha, and you'll see they offer him wine mixed with myrrh, but he does not take it. Now, myrrh is a mild narcotic. It would make you subdued and calm. It would deaden pain. Jerusalem women prepared wine mixed with myrrh for condemned men as an act of compassion. And the Romans allowed them to give it to condemned men because they needed a pliant victim. They needed someone who was not going to struggle when they nailed him to the cross. So they were fine with this act of compassion. Notice Jesus refuses the wine and the myrrh. We don't know why, and we're not told. If I were to speculate, which is never safe, but I'm going to try anyway. If I were to speculate, it would be because he wants to have his mind clear, for one. He wants to have his mind clear so he says all the things that he needs to say from the cross. And he doesn't lose it. Second, he needs to experience the full weight and consequence of sin. Physically, and as we're going to see in a minute, spiritually. He refuses the myrrh, wine. The soldiers now take the crossbeam from Simon. We know a bit about crucifixion. We know a lot about crucifixion, so I'll just tell you what happens next. The soldiers take the crossbeam from Simon. They lay it on the ground in front of a vertical beam that's already been implanted into the ground. There's already a vertical beam in the ground. They take the sign from Jesus' neck. They hammer it to the vertical beam where it'll sit above his head. They lay Jesus down on the ground, stretching out his arms on the beam. There are four men in a Roman execution squad. Three would hold Jesus down. One would take his arm and nail a large iron spike into his wrist, through the wrist, into the wood, and out the other side. After they'd done one arm, they would do the next. Then they would take the crossbeam, they would hoist it up to the already implanted vertical pole. They would affix it to that pole, either by tying it or by nailing it, or both. And then they would take his legs, his feet, and they would put one on top of the other against the vertical side of that pole, and they would drive one long spike through both feet into the wood of the other side. And the point of this is to cause the most agonizing, slow death possible. You can go online, you can read a number of different studies by doctors that tell us how someone would die once crucified. You die of asphyxiation. It's hard to breathe. You have to use your legs to push your body up to get breath into your lungs. But as your legs weaken, it's harder and harder. And so you go through oxygen panic, and it's just a terrible experience. I don't have the inclination or the time to go through it, but even more importantly, I want you to notice something in verse 24. Notice how Mark describes it. They crucified him. You see that? They crucified him. Mel Gibson spent 3 hours describing and detailing the physical agony of the cross. Mark gives us 3 words. Why is that? Why the brevity? If you look back up in through chapter 14 and 15, you'll notice that Mark records in detail the oppression of the judges, Gentile and Jew. He records in detail the fickleness of the crowd, the cowardice of Pilate, the cruelty of the soldiers. He paints a picture of universal rejection and condemnation of Jesus. But then he comes to what you would think would be the climax of the whole story, and he says they crucified him. Not much at all about his physical suffering. I think we tend to go there because we want to, I mean, I think Mel Gibson and others who go there want to stir up sympathy for Jesus. Mark doesn't go there. That tells us at least one thing. The purpose of the cross isn't to make you feel sorry for Jesus. That's not what God's doing there. I think one reason for Mark's brevity, I think the reason for Mark's brevity, is that he's already revealed the purpose of the cross. His readers know very well what is happening, and there's no need for more explanation. Turn, if you can, to Isaiah 53. I know you can, so go ahead and turn there. Isaiah 53. Isaiah lived 700 years before Jesus. Notice in this prophecy that he writes in the past tense, as if he's seen something and now he's recording something to which he was a witness, or of which he was a witness. God, it seems, gave Isaiah insight into the event that he describes, and he's coming back now to his own time and recording it as if it's a past tense event. Isaiah, beginning in verse 1 there, Isaiah sees a man who is not believed. A man who is not believed. If you've been reading Mark 1 through 15, you know Jesus is a man who is not believed. In verse 1, who has believed what he's heard from us? And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? Skip down to verse 2 a little bit. He, the man, grew up before him, God, probably at this point, but he had no form or majesty, no beauty that we should desire him. Whoever this man is, according to Isaiah, he is not desired. He's not loved. He's not wanted. Again, this is Mark 1 through 15, if you've been reading carefully. Verse 3, he was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows, acquainted with grief, and as one from whom men hide their faces, he's an object of shame, ridicule, and as one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised, and we esteemed him not. In fact, verse 4, we esteemed him as stricken, smitten by God. The we there is Isaiah and Israel together, all the people involved in this. We thought that when he suffered, when we were giving him over to death, we thought it was because he'd become a curse. Remember that language? We thought it was because he was being stricken by God for his sins. Mark's original readers would know this prophecy well, and they would know, as Mark is describing the events of Mark 14 and 15, that Jesus is walking through those events. Israel esteems him not. Now skip to verse 7. He was oppressed and he was afflicted. Yet like a lamb to his slaughter and a sheep that's before its shears is silent, so he opened not his mouth. Isn't this the trial? Isn't this how Jesus behaved before the Sanhedrin and before Pilate? He opened not his mouth. By oppression, that's false or malicious action and judgment, he was taken away. And we saw the travesty of his trials. We walked through all of them. This is Jesus before Caiaphas and Annas. This is Jesus before Pilate. The readers of Mark would know that Isaiah 53 was unfolding before their eyes as they read it. Verse 8, and as for his generation, that means his people, who considered that he was cut off of the land, or out of the land of the living, stricken for the transgression of my people? And what's the answer to that question? No one. No one considered that. They crucified him. They crucified him. Mark 15:24. No one considered. That's why they crucified him. Mark's readers know Isaiah 53, so that's all he has to say for them to understand the purpose of the cross. And you can see the purpose if you just lift your eyes back up to verse 5. He was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement, that's punishment, that brought us peace. And with his wounds, we're healed. All we, like sheep, have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way. And the Lord, notice the capital letters here, Yahweh, has laid on him the iniquity of us all. They crucified him. Look at verse 10. Jesus isn't a victim. God does not hand him over and then let it go. Verse 10, it was the will of the Lord to crush him. It was God's act through sinful men to crush him. God has put him to grief. And verse 12, the man himself, poured out his soul to death and was numbered with the transgressors. He took on the shame, he took on the humiliation, he took on the sin, and yet he bore the sin of many and makes intercession for the transgressors. So now go back to chapter 15 of Mark. The man on the cross is naked. He's weak. He's alone. He's hated. He's dying. He is esteemed not. According to Isaiah, what is going on right now as he hangs on the cross is that Jesus is enduring the torment of hell. He's enduring the infinite punishment that I deserve and that you deserve. He's enduring hell for all sinners at this point. And so it would be beside the point for Mark to go on and describe the physical agony. The point is, the purpose of the cross is that Jesus took your sin and endured your punishment. The Lord has laid on him the transgressions of us all. Jesus is sin unveiled. Now God is holy. God is holy and God is just. In fact, he is the origin of justice. And what that means is we don't worship a God like Allah. Allah, the Muslim Allah, can just wink his eyes at sin and say, okay, hey, it's all forgiven. No, we worship a God of justice who will not forgive the least of your sins of thought, word, and deed. He will punish every single sin of yours to the fullest extent of the law. That means eternal hell. But he's also, as we've been reading in our Christian education, God is also love. He is agape. And so what we have in Jesus is God taking on your hell, enduring it himself, so that you can have peace with him. And so God in Jesus refuses wine mixed with myrrh, but he takes the cup of his Father's wrath against you and me, and he drains it for you and for me and for Israel. Go ahead and look at verse 24. Of chapter 15 of Mark. If you're not, I think you're probably in Isaiah, go back to Mark. Chapter 15, verse 24. And four soldiers, the execution squad, divided his garments among them, casting lots for them to decide what each should take. Now, this was common practice. The execution squad would get the victim's belongings as a kind of compensation for the horrible work. John tells us that Jesus wore, in addition to other clothing, a seamless tunic. that they were bartering over, they were gambling for. They would have, at this point, Jesus would be completely naked. Romans did not care about the crucified man's embarrassment. In fact, the whole point of the cross was to embarrass him. He was not wearing a loincloth. Every time you see a crucifix with a loincloth, you know that's not what was going on. He was completely naked. Every article of his clothing was stripped off, and the soldiers here were bartering for all of it, or dividing some of it, bartering for the seamless tunic. Now, I want you to think of this picture here. Jesus hangs above them naked, no clothing, while they hold Jesus' clothing in their hands. Now, I want to take your mind back for a minute to the beginning. When Adam and Eve realized they were naked, what did they do? They hid, but then what? What? They sewed together fig leaves to clothe themselves. God did not think, and it was true, God did not think that clothing was sufficient. And so what did God do? Anyone know? What God did, yes, God clothed them himself in skins, we're told in chapter 3, verse 21 of Genesis. What that means is that God is the one who was the first one to kill anything in the history of the cosmos. He killed, and then he took the skin from the sacrifice beast, and he made clothes for Adam and for Eve. The first recorded death is God's work of clothing his human creatures. Now, going back forward to the cross, now God hands himself over to death, and he becomes that beast, and he gives up his clothing. And these four armed and armored men are holding it in their hands. And you know what the sad thing is here? They're holding it in their hands, and each one is willing to lose it in a bet. Each one is willing to throw the dice or whatever they're doing. What an image. What an image. God takes on, Jesus here, takes on human nakedness, human sin, and gives over his seamless, perfect tunic. His clothing is in your grasp. His clothing is in the grasp of all who want it. He offers it to the world. He offers it to sinners. But how often we sit under the cross just kind of, it's nothing, no big deal. How often the world treats the sacrifice and the atoning work of Christ as if it is nothing, and is willing to lose it and barter it away or gamble it away. My friends, Jesus today offers you the seamless robe of his perfect righteousness. It's before you. It's before you. Surrender yourself to him. Take it today. Don't treat it as nothing. Don't treat it as nothing. But if you believe that you are armed and you believe that you're armored, you might just be willing to gamble, as these soldiers do. To those who are perishing, the cross is foolishness, says Paul. To those who are being saved, it is the power of God. Verse 25 of chapter 15. It is the third hour when they crucified him. That's 9 a.m. And if you look down at verse 34, you'll see that Jesus dies at the ninth hour, which is 3 p.m. That's 6 hours on the cross in which Jesus endures damnation for everyone who believes. He endures my hell. He endures your hell. Now, you'll notice in the account that the two thieves, we're not going to talk about today, but the two thieves live longer than Jesus does. Jesus only lasts for 6 hours. And I wonder, and I don't know this for sure, and I'm not going to die on this hill, but I have to ask, is there any significance to his agony being just 6 hours. Mark and all the gospel writers are careful to record it. And I want you to remember, God, we're told, through his word, created all things in 6 days. And then he rested. And then sin entered the world, and death and hatred and misery and ruin entered the world. And now here in chapter 15 of Mark, in 6 hours, God, through his word, makes all things new. It's a recreation. In 6 hours, and then he rests. Look at verse 26. The inscription of the charge against him read, "The King of the Jews." Pilate chose those words. The Sanhedrin asked him to change them to, "This man said he was King of the Jews." Pilate said, "I've written what I have written." It was his little joke against the Jews. He thought, he knew that the Jews hate Rome. He knows that they're powerless and conquered and defeated. And so he holds Jesus up as a perfect representative of the Jewish nation. Here's your king, the King of the Jews. And you'll notice the mockery continues through verse 27. "And with him they crucified 2 robbers, one on his right and one on his left." This is a mock throne room. In the ancient world, a king would be seated between his 2 most important advisors. On his left-hand side would be his economic advisor, and on his right-hand side, his military advisor. And so here's Jesus, the King of the Jews, set between 2 robbers. Pilate's having a little joke. He's mocking the entire nation. Everyone knows that who sees it. In verses 29 through 32, Mark identifies 3 groups of witnesses. We're just going to look at the first 2 today. In verse 29, read this. "Those who passed by derided him, wagging their heads and saying, 'Aha, you who would destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself and come down from the cross.'" Now, the passerbys are the people. The people. This a road is probably running right next to Golgotha and various citizens, Jews most likely, pass by and they wag their heads. That's the first century equivalent of the face palm. It is, what a shame. He came in with such high hopes, and we had such hopes for him, and now look at him, wagging their heads. And now look what they say to him, "Save yourself." The word there, the root word there, is soter, which is the same word that's usually used to refer to eternal salvation. They're saying to him, "Come down from the cross," but the word they're using is often used differently. Let's look at verse 31. The next group, the chief priests and the scribes, mock him to one another. They don't address him. They talk to each other, but they talk loud enough so that other witnesses can hear them. And Jesus can probably hear them too. "He saved others. He cannot save himself." The same word there is used, soter. "Let the Christ, the King of Israel, come down now from the cross that we may see and believe." Now, that's a lie, of course, because he's done many miracles that they've seen and they haven't believed. So they wouldn't see and believe even if he came down. That's a lie. But again, I want you to notice this word, "save." He cannot save himself. There is great irony here, because what has been the problem in Israel all along? What has been the thing that the religious leaders of Israel have taught the people of Israel? You can save yourself. You do good things. You follow the law. You follow the regulations we give you, and you will satisfy all the requirements of a just God. You can save yourself. That's what they've been saying. And what has Jesus been saying? Oh, no, you can't. No, you can't. You are naked and weak and helpless, and you need me to save you because you can't. I hope you know that. I hope you know you cannot save yourself. That is the message of the gospel. So here's the image. These scribes and the people of Israel are saying to Jesus, "Save yourself," from a position in which they think they have saved themselves. When the Romans look at the cross, as we saw earlier, they see a cursed sinner. Excuse me. When the Jews look at the cross, they see a cursed sinner, as we said a couple of weeks ago. When the Romans look at the cross, they see a shamed jackass of a man. Jesus, however, despite the mockery, doesn't save himself. Why doesn't he save himself? Jesus doesn't save himself because you cannot save yourself. Jesus welcomes death because you are subject to death. Jesus makes himself blind and naked and pitiable because you are blind and naked and pitiable. Do you see yourself hanging there? Or do you see a donkey? Or do you see a curse? Do you know you cannot save yourself? Do you know you're helpless? If not, the cross means nothing to you. If you know it, then you see in this man the glory of God revealed in his death, because there you see the justice of God, you see the mercy of God, you see the glory of God, all the essential characters of Yahweh pouring out into the world for the salvation of sinners. Christ saves you by not saving himself. But does anyone see? There is another group of witnesses left who we'll pick up with next week. You can see them in verse 32. They were crucified with Jesus, and they also reviled him. One among them will ultimately see himself as naked, weak, and helpless. And he'll cry out for mercy. I pray that you also today, if you have not, will cry out for mercy and salvation from the Son of God, who became a sin and a curse and an object of shame for you. Let's pray.